By far the most useful weapon that the devil has in his entire armoury, we could call discouragement. We could have gone through a huge list of those weapons and implements that he uses to hinder the work of God and to thwart every effort that the Christian is involved in God's harvest field. But discouragement, sadly, takes its toll on everything. And if the devil can succeed in causing a believer or even a church and congregation to lose heart, to lose vision, and to lose their way, then I believe he has scored a very single victory. He has scored something that we would say, and we don't like giving our enemies any credence whatsoever, but he has scored a tremendous victory against the work of God. There was a time whenever the devil succeeded in hindering the work. There's no doubt that he was able to do that in the days of Ezra and other times as well. And the work had to cease until another king was raised up and then re-established the decree, and they were able to build the work. But the incident before us, I believe, this evening will give us a little insight how the devil can discourage the people of God, how he seeks to hinder the work of God. But at the same time, on the other side of that coin, we can see how the Lord encourages his people to continue working despite the hardship and the difficulty and the attacks of the enemy. And we'll soon see that those attacks in Nehemiah's day are very like those attacks that the church is receiving this very day. You have in this portion the cause and the cure of discouragement. And that's what I want to look at briefly as we come to prayer. The cause and the cure for discouragement. Think first of all then of the cause of this discouragement. I suppose we could give you many reasons tonight, and we could outline to you, I believe, many causes of discouragement among the people of God, and why the work of God has ceased, and why many have lost heart, and why many quit, throw the towel in, and resign, and walk away, and leave the work of God, and leave the church, and so on and so on. I know I could go and name so many things to you, but I want to stay within the context of Nehemiah chapter 4. I intend to stick to those things that are found in this chapter, because I feel that they do encircle so many, if not all, of the attacks of the enemy and the schemes of the evil one. I want you to think of the cause of discouragement. There was the reproach of the enemy. If you notice there in verse 1, and these glasses definitely are not working right at all. I can hardly see a thing. But it says in verse 1, "But it came to pass when Sambalad heard and that we builded the wall, he was wroth." He was full of anger. "And he took great indignation and mocked the Jews." That word "mocked" is a very interesting word. It's a word that you and I would be used to in one sense, not just because we see the mocking of the crowd and the non-Christian and the worldling. Whenever the Christian is serving or doing an open air, they mock, they jeer, they laugh. But this word "mock" isn't just to shout or laugh or walk by and just sneer. This word literally means to be in your face. In your face, that's what this word means. So these people weren't afar off laughing. They weren't observing things from a distance. They were literally in the face of these individuals. Thank you, Norman. See how we go with them. Did you sanitize them? Are they okay? Yes, they'll do. They'll do okay. Where was I now? They were in the face, that's right. They were in the face of these individuals, literally right up. Now, I know I have done open airs, and I have stood, and people have come, and they've come right into my face as I was speaking. And some are shouting. You can actually feel the breath. You can actually feel the very spittle on your face. Some have come right up to your face, and you're trying to avoid them. And there's others, and they're shouting right in your face. And there's some who come, and they just face you off. That is, they stand right in front of you, and they just stand there, and they'll not move. And they're stirring you out, and you're preaching away. And you have to literally battle with them. We have had others coming in a fierce temper, and I mean a rage. I remember seeing this lady coming. She was well over 6 feet tall. And I looked at her. I could see her coming out of her front door. And I knew that she wasn't coming over to say, "Have you any gospel tracts, sir? I'll give some out for you." She came over, but she couldn't. She was so irate, so angry, and so mad that she started to really shout before she got over. And I realized right away she's a Roman Catholic. And as she came over, she grabbed the mic and she lifted it and she started to shout throughout the whole housing estate, "The Pope is the best. The Pope is the best." And I realized we're not in a good area. Because she wouldn't have shouted that if this was a Protestant area. She definitely wouldn't. And I struggled to get the mic off her. And then this man came out. And I looked at him. And I looked again. And I said these words to myself, "Oh no, Stevie McConville." I went to school with that fella. And me and him fought the bit out. And he will come over and he is going to fight. And I prayed, but there's a man with me from the Baptist. He feared no one and nothing. And he started to preach, and I says, "We need to gather up." He says, "No, I'm preaching." I says, "We need to gather up. This will be the last message and sermon we'll preach." With my eye on this fella coming over, his wife was at the door egging him on. He comes straight over, and my first thoughts were this. Once he comes over, I'm going to reach my hand out. And I says, "Stevie McConville, Thomas Martin, I've got saved, you know, I'm a born-again Christian." And as he came, I'll never forget it, he was coming right up to my face. And when he realized it was me, I'll never forget it to the day that I die, he stopped in his tracks. He turned around. He walked straight back into his house. And his wife standing like this. I couldn't believe it. But I knew the Lord had given me a window of opportunity. I needed to get out of here. Not to preach. So I wound everything up and away. And the wrath. And it literally means, this word "mock" means to be in your face. Right in your face. And here are people working for God. And they're not only their enemies angry and filled with indignation, but they're right into their face. And that is, they face them down. That's what it means. "You'll not be doing this." And that's what's happening today. In open airs, they would have loved to have open airs today. They would sit down on a summer seat and they would listen. Folks would stop in their cars, they'd wind their windows down. There's people who said that before they were saved, some avoided open airs and others loved to hear open airs, and they lament today there's not as many. But as soon as you have an open air today, you will incur the wrath of individuals. I think one of the open airs that I remember, and there were many memorable open airs in Lisburn, one in particular, just down in Limetree. We'd only set up, I'd just begun to preach, folks were giving out gospel literature, and I heard this commotion, and I knew full well, here's trouble. And I just preached on, and I'd hoped that there was enough around me that would stop this man getting to me. And suddenly he came right up into my face as I was preaching. And he says, "Keep it down. You shouldn't be here preaching at this time of night. We have children in bed," and so on and so on. It was only 11 o'clock at night. What's he talking about? No, I'm only jesting. It was 8:30. And I thought to myself, I'm going to preach on here. And there's a man standing, and he says, "You're not wanted around here." And this man, and I mean, he was just standing with a dog. He was walking a dog, and here's me, here we go. And he came up to his face and faced him down. And here's him says, "Well, I live round here, and I want this man preaching here." And the man just turned tail and away. But I'm telling you, we will meet opposition in your face. That's what you're getting. Now, we may not agree with some of those that are conducting open airs. We may not stroke their T's and dot their I's. And they may be charismatic or even Pentecostal. And they may be little house groups, but some of them are very bold for the Lord. And we can't fault that. We might find fault with them in some of their theology. But they have open airs in different places. And at this present time, the open air that some of these people are having outside the city hall at the weekend, the sodomites are gathering to oppose them. And they're mocking them. They're laughing at them. And these people are preaching away. Now, we may not fully agree with all their doctrine, but I can tell you something. They have a holy boldness. And these people, and I mean they're vile, absolutely vile. You could not bring children to those open airs. They're vile. And they mock, they laugh. In fact, I think just recently the police had to remove them. I think one of the young girls was arrested, and those that were standing there were preaching away. But the venom and the hatred, I believe that's exactly what Nehemiah faced. We don't realise it, what he faced, until we face something of what's said here. They were wroth, and they were took great indignation, and they mocked. They were right in their face. They faced them down, and they tried to stop and hinder the work of God. And I'm sure if that happened, you would discover, if we had a well-attended open air and people were taking all the gospel literature, one or two people said they got saved over the last number of months because of the open airs, all of a sudden more people come to the open air. And then they say, you know, it was great because it's an opportunity to give your testimony, and people were talking to me when I met them, I heard you, and I really enjoyed that, even though I'm not saved. People were opening their windows, people were sitting on a wee deck chair in their garden. Wouldn't open airs be great? But if you've got a community and you've got people and they're facing you down, I guarantee you, as the weeks go on, if you were doing regular open air work through the summer months, as the weeks go on, you will discover the crowd will get less and less. Not the opposition crowd, but the believer. The believer would be discouraged. And these people tried the first tactic: we'll face them down, and we'll stop them doing what they're doing. And that's what the sodomite, the abortion lobbyists, and you put them all in there, they're all in there. The ecumenical churches, they're all in there. You put in the apostasy, they're in there. You put in the those that are atheistic and humanistic, you put them in there, the worldling, the ungodly, the so-called Protestant, the so-called loyalists, they're all in there. And they'll all oppose the gospel and the preaching of that gospel. They will oppose the stand of the believer, and they will oppose you, and they will oppose me. They will oppose the stand of this church, and they will face us down. And if that doesn't work, then they will go to another tactic. That's exactly what happened here, because it didn't succeed. I do believe it succeeded in a measure. There certainly were those that were fearful. There were those that didn't want to work. There were those that couldn't take the flak. And they had to perhaps just be forced by Nehemiah to say, we need to do this. We need to stand. We don't need to be faced down with these individuals. So there was the reproach of the enemy, that's for sure. Notice there was the subtle undermining of all that they were doing as well in their reproach. Look what it says there in the verse 3. It tells us now, even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. The undermined, the subtle undermining. What on earth are you doing? Sure, if a fox goes up, a little fox tried to jump over that wall or even fell into the wall and didn't see it, a fox would knock it down. Do you think that's going to keep us out? Do you think for one moment that you're going to hide behind that wall and you're going to literally have protection? A fox goes up, we wouldn't even need an army. All the army of Samaria, we wouldn't need them. We wouldn't need the Ammonites and the Ashdodites and the Arabians. No, just Sanballat and Tobiah and Gershom the Arabian, a few others. We could go up. We could be like a little fox and we could destroy those walls. We could literally walk up in the middle of the night and just push them over. And they would just fall and crumble. What do these feeble Jews, weak, insignificant Jews, what do they think they're doing? I tell you something, it's very hard to keep working for God and doing what God wants us to do when you've got that type of opposition, when you've got that cruel mocking and reproach of the enemy. And you notice something else here as well, what it says in verses 7 and 8, after they could not literally discourage them by these attempts. Look what they did in 7 and 8. It says there, but it came to pass when, and it goes on to name all those peoples, heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up, the breaches began to be stopped, they were very wroth. And look what it says in verse 8. They conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it, to fight. You see, they will never give up. They will not give up. And if they can't bring reproach and discourage you that way, if they can't stop the work of God by facing you down and besmirching your testimony and belittling you and what you're doing, you're a feeble person running on a Tuesday night to that church building to what? To what? Talk to one another. Talk to the air. You think God's listening to you? Well, you're just feeble people. That's all you are. You're weak-minded individuals. That's what the enemy's saying. That's what they're saying. And if they cannot face us down, then they will seek to close us down. And that's what they'll try to do. And by means and different means, they will seek to close us down. They will stop our open air work. They will stop our evangelism. Already, people place on their doors, I've never seen as many doors now that say no religious groups. You're not wanted. No religious groups. I saw it one time and I thought, New Age people, that all these different things hanging. And I thought to myself, no religious groups. Well, maybe I'll take that as Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. I was just about to put the gospel literature through the door. I learned my lesson. I don't do it now. I go to the gate and I do what Scripture says and I take both my feet and I shake the dust off my feet. That's what I do at their gate. I stand at their gate and I literally do what Christ said, shake the dust. But on one occasion, and I learnt my lesson, I was about to put it through, and the door opened, and here fell through. And this big fellow with long hair, like a hippie, he says, "Can you not read?" I says, "I can. I can read." He says, "Well, I don't want it." I says, "Any reason?" He says, "I don't want it." And the aggression, and I knew full well, do not push this guy. Do not push this fella. I tried to be as courteous and as kind as I could. You don't want to argue with them, fight with them. But they wanted to fight with me. They wanted to contend with me. And it is now in singular homes, they're saying no religious groups. And those little stickers are appearing on every single door. You do so many doors and suddenly no religious group. Now we know it does say no junk mail, but the gospel's not junk. So we're okay with that one. We still put it through. But when it says no religious groups, that's what I do. Fair enough. No gospel for you, no Christ for you. Well, the only person, and we mean this metaphorically speaking, the only person will walk down your laneway and your little path will be Christ. And I'll shake the dust so the dust will settle. And the only other footprints in judgment that will ever come in relation to the Lord will be the Lord's feet to either take you into eternity and death or to take you into eternity at his second coming. So you can see the tactics. If they can't discourage us in one way, then they'll begin to fight with us. But furthermore, another cause for discouragement was not only the reproach of the enemy, but the hardness of the work. Look what it says in verse 10. Look what it says in the verse 10. It tells us there in verse 10, "And Judah..." Now, these are the people of God, "said, the strength of the bearers of burden is decayed, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build the wall." And that is true, because the old walls were broken down, and all the mortar that brought them together was all lying about the place. They had burned all the gates made of wood, and the iron was lying there. They destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and it was lying in heaps. It was just like a rubbish tip. And when you go, you couldn't even see, well, where are the foundations of this wall? Where does it begin? Is it here, or is it maybe at the back of that church? Where does the wall begin? Where is the borderline here? They couldn't see it because there was that much rubbish. So they needed to clear it all away, put it all away. They had no diggers. They do it by hand, big, huge stones, and all the muck and all the filth. And there's no doubt that those who remained behind during the 70 years of captivity, they wouldn't have been burning rubbish. They just piled it up. 70 years of rubbish just lying there. Now, there's no doubt there was a little cleaned up whenever Zerubbabel came back and he laid the foundation of the temple. But mostly those walls were just left and all the rubbish was just piled. It's basically you build at the centre and you just pushed everything out to the side. And those who were believers and those who were working, they came in and they discouraged. And they says, look, this is impossible. This is impossible. I'm sure you've had that in the secular world. You come in and if you work in an office, there's a pile of papers and you'd say, I'll never get through that. I'll never get through that. Yet somebody else comes in, says, excuse me, and takes the whole lot, and within 2 hours they're through it all. But you would never get through it. And that's sometimes how we work in the secular field. We could go in and we'd say, look at the cut of this, we'll never get this done. Never. Look at it. She'll have a week's work before we even start to work. But here's the case. Judah says, look, it's impossible. We'll never get this done. And there's too much rubbish. And the strength of the bearers of burden is decayed. In fact, we're too weak. We're insignificant. We haven't enough personnel. We don't have enough people on site to get this thing finished. This is a madness. What on earth are we doing? So when the enemy was overcome, they found a new enemy. Who was it? The Christian. That's hard to believe, but it's true. Whenever we commenced an extension work in Achalee from Lisburn, some of those that opposed that work were actually believers. One man said to me, I quote, and he says, "What on earth are you people doing in Achalee?" And he says, we're building a church. Building a church. And here's what he says. There's nothing in Achalee. Nothing there. You haven't even got a congregation. And that was true. We didn't. The man offered us a site. We prayed about it. He prayed about it. And we found the mind of God and the will of God. And the money that they had for building the new church in Lisburn was about £350,000. And they gave most of it, if not all of it, to the building of Achalee and left themselves with very little money in the bank. That's a fact. Believing it to be the will of God. For the Lord had need of it. And we had to loose it and let it go. But I tell you, some of the opposition we got was from believers. That work is now up and running with its own minister, its session committee, Sunday school, outreach work, children's work, and it also has a faithful prayer meeting and so on. I want to tell you something. Many precious souls have been saved through the witness in Achalee. So what are we doing? There's nothing there. Well, I can tell you something. If we had listened to those people, we never would have finished that work. But God provided, God blessed. So I want to tell you something. The work is hard. I will say this to you. And I've been talking to some pastors and ministers this past while. Every one of them have this conversation. That the ministry and the work of God has never been as hard. It's never been as hard. And it's just not COVID. It's just not COVID-19. It's so many difficulties, so many problems, so many discouragements. And, you know, if you were to go to America and you were to get the statistics for pastors and ministers that have dropped out of the ministry, it's staggering, absolutely staggering to see how many never finish. And then church membership, how many church members never stay to the end. And it takes very little, to push them away, to keep them at home, or to bring them somewhere else. It's a fact. It is a fact. It's very, very, very hard. And especially when I see these young men coming in and I make them the object of my prayers. I know when I started the ministry and where I am now, and other men in longer than I am, that these young men coming into ministry now, it's very difficult. No one will understand, unless you are a minister, what these young men will face in their ministry and in their entire pastoral work. But I want to say something to you. We're called to work and we're called to watch. And I do believe that these two duties of Christian service were vital here in the work in Nehemiah's day. And they are vital in our day as well. And you know, it's amazing that Judah, if you notice there in the verse 10 what it does say, verse 12. Look what it says in verse 12 about the men of Judah. And it came to pass that when those Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times. 10 times. Now it's bad enough if someone comes to you 2 times or 3 times with the same problem and complaint. But if someone came to you 10 times, I guarantee you that would make you irate. It would. It would really cause you to lose heart. And these people of Judah, these men and women, they should have known better. They came 10 times to Nehemiah and 10 times to the leaders and to the workers. And they said, there's much rubbish. And not only that, but our adversaries are only a stone's throw away. And they've told us that they're going to destroy us. And they've got their army ready. And we have nothing. All we have is an old trowel in our hand and an old blunt sword at our side. And you expect us to work and to fight at the same time? Sure, the strength of the burden of the bearers has decayed. There's much rubbish and the work's impossible. And then 10 times they came and told them, oh, by the way, we're going to be killed. We're going to have a watch at night, you know. You know what it is? It's really saying, look, let's stop this work. Let's not do this work. And then the enemy will go away. And then we could live a bit more comfortable. Do we really need these walls? Sure, we can't keep them out anyway. But you see, the walls, as I said in prayer, the walls were symbolic. The walls were not just to defend Jerusalem or to keep the enemy out or the people in. Those walls symbolize separation unto God. That's what those walls meant. They were symbolic. And I would have to agree with some of the enemies. Yes, it was like a feeble wall. It wouldn't have been the walls you'd have made today. But I will say this, that those walls were fortified at other occasions. But those walls in their beginning in 52 days, that's how long it took them to build the walls of Jerusalem. So it was a hurried work. They couldn't have put everything into it. But Nehemiah saw these walls as a symbol that they are a people that are separated unto God. And if those walls remain knocked down, then spiritually the enemy walks in. And you know, it's very applicable to the free church today, because the walls of separation could easily be broken down. And it is true. The walls of separation could easily be broken down. And the enemy could come in and they could make deals with us. We could buy and sell with them. And then there'd be intermarriage and all of those things. The walls of separation could easily be broken down. And that's the aim of the enemy, to stop these walls of separation being built. If there's one doctrine that the world hates, it's the doctrine of separation. Separate from the world and separated unto God and the gospel. And then we have not only the cause, and I'll hurry on, but you have the cure for discouragement. The Lord's not unmindful of the discouragements that we all face in the work of God, and we have touched upon some of those that are found in the passage here. You do have, I believe, the cure. Because even though, and this is a remarkable thing, even though these Christians and these believers, these Jews of Judah, discouraged the people, they were individuals who lived close to the world. Because the Bible tells us in verse 12 that they lived nearby them. That is, they were close to the enemy. It's like a believer living as close to the world as they possibly can. It's as if they go to church on a Sunday, they're in the public house on a Monday night, but they're only drinking a shandy. They're just living as close to the world as they can. You know, I don't do the lottery, but I do a scratch card. You know, I don't really smoke, but a vape. I don't really, you know, take drugs, but I would smoke just a wee bit of marijuana. Do you know Christians are doing that? That's a fact. That is a fact. And so what you've got here is believers who are living as close to the world as they possibly can. And they become discouragers. And they break down the walls of separation in any denomination or any church or any congregation or fellowship of God's people. But the Lord gives to us the cure for this discouragement, for he's not unmindful that we do get discouraged. And as such, he's given us, I believe, a remedy for these things. Encouragement. He's given us hope. He's given us a way to overcome the enemy and the discouragements of the world and even those who are well-meaning believers. Firstly, in the midst of great discouragement, you'll notice that we are encouraged to ponder. Look what it says in verse 14. We're encouraged to ponder. Verse chapter 4, verse 14, and it says, "Be not ye afraid of them," the middle of the verse, "remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight." You see it? Remember the Lord. Be not afraid of them. Remember your God and recall, ponder who he is. He's great toward you in his mercy and his love and his help, and he's terrible in his judgments against the wicked. Remember what happened to the world in Noah's day. Remember what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah in the days of Lot. Remember what happened to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and the Egyptian armies when they pursued after the people of God. Remember, and the history could be recalled right through. Remember what God has done. He's great toward Israel and his people. And he's great in his mercy and his love and in his grace. But yet he's a terrible God who doeth wondrous things. And he's a God of judgment. And the enemy are but grasshoppers before him. And we should not be afraid of them. Be not afraid of them. Don't you be afraid of them. But ponder this. Remember Adonai. Because that's the very name that's used here in chapter 4 and verse 14. Let us remember what the Lord can do. And let us remember what he has already done for us. Secondly, not only in the midst of discouragement are we encouraged to ponder, but secondly, we're also encouraged to pray. Look at verse 9. I like what it says here in the verse 9. A remarkable word. Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch. We made our prayer. And he also prayed as well, if you notice there, in that verses 4 and 5. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of their captivity, and cover not their iniquity, etc., etc. For they have provoked to anger thy builders, thy workers, thy people. And he asked God to look upon it. And so the cure for discouragement is to ponder. Remember the Lord. Turn to the Lord. Look upon him. Remember who he is. And I tell you, that's a cure for discouragement. You could not fear the enemy if you have a vision of your God, how great he is, how terrible he is. And you look at puny man, and they're trying to face off God, and they're trying to mock, and they're trying to rebel and overthrow God and his work. Impossible. But if you have only your eye on the enemy and not on your God, you will compare them to yourself and you will be discouraged. So the cure is this, to keep your eye on the Lord. And furthermore, to pray. So you not only to ponder, but to pray. Prayerlessness, I believe, gives a foothold to the enemy. And then finally, we're encouraged to persevere. Notice what it says there in the verse 6 of this chapter 4. It tells us there, so built we the wall. They persevered. Even though there was opposition, mockery, wrath, indignation, they were coming to fight with them. And then was the threat of death. And look what it says. So built we the wall. So ceased we building. So we threw the towel in. So we decided to just tuck ourselves away in some of the other little hamlets across the land of Israel where they couldn't find us, and leave Jerusalem to those aged and infirmed individuals and hoped that they will find a happy life. No, no, no. So built we the wall. They weren't going to stop. They weren't going to be put off. Do what you like. Do what you like. But we will ponder. Remember the Lord. We'll keep our eyes on God. And we will pray. We will pray. And then we will persevere. So built we the wall. And look what it says there as well. In the chapter 6, or sorry, verse 21. So we labored in the work. So we labored in the work. And I like what it says in chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was finished. In the 25th day of the month, Elul, in 52 days. 52 days. And what did the men of Judah say? We're not able to finish this. 52 days. The walls were up, and the people had the symbol of separation to the nations built, and they were shut into God, and they could worship in the temple. And I want to tell you something. Others may be discouraged. Others may try to discourage you. But R.A. Torrey, the great writer, and you should get any book that R.A. Torrey has written, you should get it. Any book that he has written, you should have that in your library as a Christian, and you should read it and study it. Any book, any volume. But R.A. Torrey said this, I quote, he says, I refuse to listen to the devil's discouragements. I refuse to listen to the devil's discouragements. You know, when I first came to Lisburn as a young student and a licentiate, I entered into the minister's room with Dr. Douglas. And Dr. Douglas says to me, Thomas, I still get nervous, you know, if I ever go out to preach, although I was preaching that night. I says, do you? He says, I do. And I was thinking to myself, if he's nervous, what am I like? And I could see him. Any time he was preaching, he was very nervous. And he didn't mind me saying this, but he said these words to me. He says, you know, many a Sunday night I wondered, will there be anybody in tonight to hear me preach? And he says, I used to get down at that door and look through the wee keyhole. And I had a wee look like that, but I couldn't see everything, but I could just see empty spaces. And then I walked about, and I was so nervous. And I thought to myself, he's making me nervous now. He's really making me nervous. And then I entered in, basically, to what he was talking about. When I first came there, a row of seats empty here, a seat empty there, seats empty there. Where are these people? I didn't know who they were. I asked questions. Are they way to Whitewell? They're way here, they're way there. What has happened? We don't know. These ones here are out of sorts. You may go and visit them, but you may never get them back, and so on. And I couldn't believe it. And so I went home every Sunday night. There's my wife sitting in this meeting. She'll tell you this is true. I would have even woken June up in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock. If I see her moving, I would say, are you awake? What? I says, was such and such in the night? Was such? And she says, I don't know. I said, do you not look? Do you not find out? You need to know. And I just, Sunday night, I just lay awake for months, if not years, couldn't sleep, wondering where people were. But I read part of the life story of Charles Simeon. Charles Simeon was put in to an Anglican church along with the Reverend Honeyford. Most people liked the Reverend Honeyford for one reason, because Charles Simeon was evangelical and the Reverend Honeyford wasn't. They didn't like his ministry because he preached the gospel. And people in those days owned their pew boxes. They paid for them and they owned them. So whenever he was preaching, they closed their pew boxes and put a lock on them. And they refused any person who attended the meetings of Charles Simeon. And so what he had to do every Sunday night was gather chairs and put them up and down the aisles. And he did that for 12 years non-stop. And a dear saint of God came up to him one day and said, "Mr. Simeon, I can understand why for 12 years you have suffered this in this church." And he says, "How have you done that? How have you done it?" And here's what he said, never forget it. He says, "Madam, I can give you two reasons. The first reason is this, Paul's words to Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive. And secondly, madam, I don't look anymore at those that are not here. But I thank God there are those who come to hear Charles Simeon preach the old evangel." And my heart was lifted. And I have slept reasonably well, not great, but reasonably well ever since I heard that. We could spend our time looking at people who are not here and forgetting about you who are here. And thank God for you, that you're in your place on a Tuesday night, on a Sunday morning, and a Sunday evening, and sometimes beyond even that which is required of a member. You're in your place and you're doing what you can. And so it'd be easy to get discouraged by looking, why is nobody sitting there? Why is these chairs empty? Where are these people? But I got over that a long, long time ago. And years and experience teach you to thank God for those things that are positive and not those things that discourage the heart. I refuse to listen to the devil's discouragement. Will you do that? And will you ponder the great God you have? Will you pray and then persevere for the people that are mine to work? And they finished the wall, the work they were called to do. May God bless and encourage our hearts tonight in his word. To say to our internet listeners, if they haven't been cut off already, thank you for joining with us. We leave you now just for a little season as we're going to meet with the Lord in prayer.